You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Lights out, everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh, and today I am joined by a guest co-host. It's not Ian. Ian is thousands of miles away right now on the other side of the world, enjoying some much-needed time off. But I am joined by the one and only Annabelle, and she has been locked away for quite a while now, and I think she's very excited to be back on set for the show. I've missed you, and please don't kill me. She hasn't done anything yet. She's been locked away in her box, but you know, you break her out of her box, you never know what could happen. But today, I am here with Daniel, of course.
How's it going? I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good.
The reception to the new studio was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
It was awesome to see.
I'm glad that people like it.
Yeah. It's we made a few tweaks for this episode with the lighting, because there's a lot going on in the background and the bookshelves too. We have like wainscoting on the walls. Like a lot of detail was just blacked out, which is fitting for this show. But, you know, I wanted to bump the lighting up a little bit just so you can see more of what's going on behind us, because there's a lot of cool stuff in here. But today we're going to be getting into a paranormal case that I ran across. I had never heard of before. The case is known as the South Shields Poltergeist case. But is this an actual poltergeist case or not? I think that'll be up for you to decide by the end of this, because to me it kind of seems like there's something more sinister going on here, because this family and kids are absolutely tormented by some type of entity that throughout this entire experience is communicating with them through the most creepy ways. And for as long as I've been doing this show, I've always thought and had this sort of little bit of paranoia in the back of my head of when I'm listening to the baby monitors at night, because I've got a 4-month-old and I've got a 4-year-old, and I've got, you know, baby monitors set up for both of them, and they're on my phone all night long. I can hear their rooms. And I'm always a little anxious at night, because I'm like, what if I start hearing voices coming through the monitors that aren't their cries or their voices? That's going to really freak me out. So I can't even imagine what this would actually be like to experience something dark, something sinister, communicating through my child's toys, through the baby monitors. I mean, I think that would creep me out on a whole other level. And I mean, these days, right, like, hackers are hacking baby monitors, which is terrifying in its own right. But something ghostly, like a ghostly voice coming through, I mean, that would just be straight chilling, I think. But what makes this case so interesting is that this was actually highly investigated by some very experienced paranormal investigators. And even they were kind of blown away at the sheer magnitude of paranormal activity that took place in this family's home from December 2005 to October 2006. And I feel like a lot of paranormal cases take place, you know, 10, 20, 30, you know, years ago. And so this being within the last 20 years makes it all that more interesting to me because of modern technology and tools at our disposal. So let's go ahead and get into the story of the South Shields poltergeist case. So Mark and Marianne were standing in their 3-year-old son Robert's bedroom. They've been trying to contact his imaginary friend, Sammy, who they believed was actually the ghost behind multiple disturbances in their home. As Mark talked gently to the spirit, Robert's doodle board fell out of the cupboard, and when they picked it up, it read, "I'm sorry." This was their first contact, so they wanted to learn as much as they possibly could. Marianne would set the board in the cupboard with the door closed, and when she took it out, new words would magically appear. After some correspondence, Mark and Marianne were excited that they might find a resolution to the horror that they'd been experiencing. But they weren't just dealing with a ghost of a little boy. They were dealing with what they believed to be a poltergeist. And as Marianne took the doodle board out for the last time, eager to see Sammy's response, she saw one word that would make her blood run cold. Die. Before we get into things, we should say that the family has been kept entirely anonymous in this case. And so the names that we'll use are aliases, and even the address 42 Lock Street is one that the investigators invented to protect them. And we don't have much background information on this family, but let's go ahead and get into what we know about them and the house that they lived in. The haunting began in 2005, according to investigators, and Mark Carlson and Marianne Petersworth lived at 42 Lock Street with their three-year-old son, Robert. It was December in South Shields, a coastal town in South Tyneside, England. And this area is particularly known for its rich folklore about seafaring spirits and shipwrecks, and over time, ghost stories have emerged and become a popular tradition in the community. And surprisingly though, 42 Lock Street wasn't your average looking haunted house. It was a very ordinary 1970s brick two-bedroom terrace house in good condition. There wasn't any mold or subsidence, making it a neat and safe little home. Until December 2005, when everything spiraled out of control. At the time, Marianne was supervising at a local care home, and that's where she met her partner, Mark. And they were both in their early 20s and were known as a very sweet and loving couple. Marianne had long blonde hair and was a gracious host to her visitors. Her son Robert was an unusually smart and outgoing child. Mark, on the other hand, was handsome with close-cropped hair and strong masculine features. He wasn't Robert's biological father, but he treated him as his own. And Mark was generally considered to be a positive person, yet he found it difficult to withstand what was coming. And having just endured a great loss in his family, he was already dealing with that trauma when the chaos began, and the entity used his turmoil against him. Which leads us to the happenings in the home. One of the most interesting things in this case, and there are many, is that the family had already been living in the house for a couple years when the spiritual invasion began. The disturbances cropped up without warning, and the young couple wondered how this presence managed to slither its way into their home.
It started with small, trivial disturbances that could be explained away. For example, the water started dripping from the shower, which wasn't that alarming. It became unsettling, though, when they would come home to the shower running when nobody was there. Then, the cat and dog became anxious in the house, especially around the upstairs landing. The dog would bark, the cat would hiss, and they always seemed panicked in that area of the home. One afternoon, as Marianne and her father were talking in the kitchen, they both saw a mug slowly edge itself off the counter before falling. Marianne put it back, but they were speechless when it immediately thrust itself off the counter and back onto the floor. At night, the couple would hear strange noises around the house and thought it might just be a draft or the wind outside. One evening, though, they heard something completely unnatural. A voice came whispering on the baby monitor, warning them that Robert was about to fall from his crib. They raced upstairs, but they found the toddler peacefully sleeping. They told themselves that they were just hearing things, but soon other people started noticing the plague spreading through their home. One night, while Mark was sitting with a female friend, he suddenly heard a sharp whisper in his ear, "Bitch." At first, Mark assumed it was his friend playing a prank on him. When he looked at her, though, she was pale all over. She had also heard the voice, and now they were both terrified. Was it really a whisper, or was there someone, or something, speaking inside their minds? On another occasion, Marianne was visiting with her father again in the kitchen when they saw a cup plummet from the upstairs window into the garden, smashing onto the ground. Robert's room was directly above them, so they checked it out and found the window closed and locked with the blinds down.
the toddler wouldn't have been able to open the window and throw that cup out by himself. So who did?
Then, after coming home after a night out, Marianne's brother Ian found Robert's toy rocking horse hanging from the attic door by its reins, swinging silently as if something had just let it go. The rocking horse became almost symbolic of the horrifying activity in the house. On another night when the couple returned home, they saw the rocking horse on the landing, staring straight down at them. Of course, they just picked it up and returned it back to Robert's bedroom, which they found in shambles. His bed and other furniture had been shuffled around, and the whole room was a disaster with clothes and toys strewn across the floor. And I think at first, your mind goes to a more rational explanation. Perhaps there's some type of intruder, someone perhaps broke into the home, is just fucking with them. But I mean, to see a child's rocking horse hanging almost as if it's hanging from a noose from the attic door is very alarming, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody is fucking with you, it's pretty fucked up.
It's threatening, to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, especially to go after your kid's room. I mean, if I went into my kid's room and it was it was this unexplained mess and, you know, one of her dolls was hanging from a rope or something, I mean, I'd be pretty scared. And I would probably be thinking, you know, somebody must have broke in the middle of the night or something like that. And so that's what the family's thinking at this point. Because Mark looked around the house for any signs of an intruder, but after he did, there was nothing. It was a small place, so it wasn't like somebody could just sneak in easily and go unnoticed. At this point, they were freaked out, but they tried to move past it. So they cleaned up the room and went downstairs to start dinner. Before they could finish eating, though, they heard loud, thunderous noises upstairs. So they raced up to the second floor and stopped in their tracks. The rocking horse was back on the landing. And when they got to the room, they found it again, in a complete mess. But this time, it was even worse. Mark, tired of the horse, took it outside and left it in the garden. The couple then tried to calm down and go to bed. But their much-needed rest was short-lived. When they woke up the next morning, guess what? The rocking horse was waiting for them in the middle of the kitchen, reminding them that it wasn't going anywhere. And it seemed that this was just life now. All the troubling events weighed on Mark and Marianne's minds every day. But they had jobs, and they had a young child to focus on. But poltergeists don't care about your livelihood. The couple wondered whether they should seek professional help, risking being turned away or humiliated, but thankfully help came to them first. On June 19, 2006, a colleague approached Darren Ritson, a well-known paranormal investigator by then, and told him that her friend's daughter had a ghost. He contacted the family and advised them on how to handle the situation. He asked them to create a diary of events to note who witnessed the happenings and, most importantly, to stay calm. With all of his experience, he knew that poltergeist activity usually goes away on its own. Darren didn't realize, though, that this haunting wasn't stopping anytime soon. This episode is brought to you by Hungry Root. Hungry Root is one of my favorite services that I pay for on a monthly basis because my family absolutely loves it. When I get home from work, my daughter is usually very hungry and is trying to raid the pantry for snacks. And so I've got to get a delicious meal on the table as quickly as possible before she drains the chip bag. And so Hungry Root comes in clutch 3 times a week for us at my house because I can get a delicious meal on the table in 15 minutes or less. Last week we had a miso ramen with chicken. It was absolutely amazing, and I'll definitely be getting that recipe again. We also love their chili limon chicken, which is sous vide, and all you've got to do is heat it up. And that's the great thing about Hungry Root recipes. They are truly so simple to put together. Also with Hungry Root, you're going to be exposed to a lot of new brands that you haven't heard of before. On Friday night, we had stuffed bell peppers with like seasoned beef, and they were absolutely delicious. And two of the sides that came with that was a Mexican rice and a Cuban spiced black beans. And the great thing about those is that you just heat them up in the microwave, but they taste like they were just made fresh right there in your kitchen. It's that simple, that easy. We love all of Hungry Root's recipes. We get 2 lunches a week and then 3 dinners. And for lunches, we usually do their salads with like steak or with chicken. And it's just an easy, nutritious meal that I don't have to think about. They have over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes and they have 1,000 grocery items. So they have snacks. They have like hummus packs. They have cheese and crackers, you name it. And it all shows up right at your door conveniently. and you just pick everything out on the app, and then that's it. You sit back, relax, and let it show up at your door. I know you're going to love Hungry Root as much as I do, and for a limited time, you can get 40% off your first order, plus get a free item in every box for life. Go to hungryroot.com/lightsout and use code LIGHTSOUT. That's hungryroot.com/lightsout. Use code LIGHTSOUT for 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life.
On July 13th, 2006, at around 11 p.m., Mark was sorting through some furniture when suddenly a heavy wooden bed frame lurched forward from the wall and fell on top of him. He stuck out his arm to stop it from crushing his head, and it hit so hard that it left a bruise. This could have been a freak accident, but to Mark, it felt intentional. Then, things became even more worrying when Robert began talking to himself, or so they thought he was. One day, Marianne heard Robert chatting with someone in his room. It's fairly normal for toddlers to talk to themselves or imaginary friends, but this sounded like a true back-and-forth conversation. She asked him who he was talking to, and he said it was his friend Sammy, who he had recently started playing with. Marianne convinced herself it must be his childlike imagination, but then Robert pushed it further. His new friend wasn't always nice, and sometimes Sammy would shove and berate him. Robert also said that Sammy had bubbly skin, almost as if he were a burn victim. Marianne just nodded and carried on, hoping Robert wouldn't notice how terrified she was. Could he have seen a burn victim on TV or something? Where did he get the name Sammy from? And why was Sammy so violent? She had to tell herself that Robert was just being a kid and making things up. As time went on, though, she realized that Sammy might actually be real and brought others along with him. The activity became increasingly physical from there, putting everyone in harm's way. In the following weeks, chairs would suddenly be pulled out from under Mark and Marianne as they were sitting down. Coins would drop from the ceiling and hit them painfully on the head or clatter to the floor. And it seems that coins are actually a common fixation for poltergeists. For example, investigators in cases like Enfield described coins and small objects appearing and being thrown throughout the hauntings. Anytime it seemed like things couldn't get worse, they did. Robert's toys would turn on completely on their own, even with the batteries out. And one time, a toy parrot began shouting words that weren't programmed into it, something that should have been impossible. The toilet would fill with blood-colored liquid that supposedly flushed itself down, and Mark and Marianne also began to worry that the evil presence would start following them to work. The parents were reaching their breaking point, though, when a parent's worst nightmare happened. Robert suddenly disappeared. One night, they couldn't find the toddler in his bed. They were hysterical, running from room to room searching, and finally, they found him locked in a closet, tightly swaddled in a blanket. He was unharmed, but seriously shaken. There was no way he could have crawled into the closet and wrapped himself up that tightly, and it was almost as if he had been abducted.
Which this, to me, is a parent's worst nightmare, to wake up, go and look for your child, and they're not in their room, and you can't find them anywhere, only to find them locked in some random closet. I mean, that is just terrifying, and I think really steps up the threat here in this particular case. And I can't even imagine what they must have been thinking at this point. I mean, he's talking to himself, and there's clearly something that has some influence over him. And I mean, this sounds like some straight out of a horror movie.
It does.
Really.
I find it very creepy that, you know, he was also swaddled so tightly inside, because it shows that whoever or whatever did this has control and restraint, which kind of shows me that it's capable of doing more, but is choosing not to. It's very intentional with its actions.
Yeah, which is just terrifying. And the end to the torment was nowhere in sight, and it seemed that the spirit wanted to assert its dominion over Robert. On several occasions, the family had fled to Marion's mother's house, and this particular instance truly showed them the danger they were all in, especially Robert. Mark and Marianne went upstairs to get him ready to leave for the night, and when they entered his room, they instantly noticed that his bed was empty again, and this time, he was face down on the floor. Again, he was wrapped tightly in a blanket like a hostage pinned down by his blue plastic table. Marianne quickly freed him and turned him around, but she was paralyzed with dread at what she saw. Robert's eyes were wide open, staring coldly ahead, as if he were in a deep trance. He still seemed to be sleeping, his shallow breathing and relaxed body making him look like an inanimate doll. Marianne held him to her chest for a long time, trying to calm herself down, praying that he would snap out of it. He eventually did wake up and return to normal, but it was one of the most horrifying things his parents had ever experienced. How do you protect your child from something you can't see, or even worse, something you can't even comprehend? After this heart-stopping encounter, Marianne called Darren in serious distress and described all the terrible things that were happening. Objects were thrown across the room, doors creaked open and slammed shut on their own. Thumps and bangs reverberated throughout the house. The water turned on randomly, and their belongings would disappear and reappear without explanation. And Robert could see the spirits and was now being physically possessed by them. Marianne begged for Darren to inspect the house, which he was more than happy to do. First, he called his friend, Mike Hallowell. At the time, Mike was a leading figure in the Northern England paranormal scene and had been investigating for over 35 years. Darren asked him to tag along on their first visit, and Mike happily accepted the invitation, believing the events described were, quote, too good to be true. The team didn't expect to find anything on their first visit because it's rare for paranormal investigators to do so. They were pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised, though, when the poltergeist made itself known almost immediately.
After arriving at 42 Lock Street on July 17th, 2006, Mike and Darren set up cameras, motion sensors, and tape recorders in different locations throughout the home. The activity had now been going on for around 7 months, and it wasn't about to let up. As they arranged their equipment, both Darren and Mike suddenly felt a cold plunge in temperature and knew they were about to encounter the prolific poltergeist. They excitedly began interviewing the couple and inspecting the home. Only 4 hours had passed on the first day when they witnessed their first real conflict with the rampant spirit. They were in Robert's room, the hub of activity, between 3 and 4 p.m., when Mike saw a subtle shadow in the corner of his eye. Just as he was trying to focus on what he just saw, a yellow plastic toy nut flew off of Robert's play workbench. It careened through the air before bouncing off of a cupboard, then striking Marianne in the lower back. The impact was so harsh that she yelled out in pain as it hit her, making a cracking sound as if it were a lightning strike. As they were processing what had just happened, another toy slid off of the dresser and landed with a clash in the metal waste bin next to it. After seeing that, Mike and Darren labeled it a live case and concluded that it needed further investigation. There is no way for them to deny what they had just witnessed, but they needed to find out who or what was tormenting this young family. Later that day, Mike and Darren asked everyone to be quiet and stay out of Robert's room so they could record sound in there. During playback, they heard consistent creaking and knocking, a strange pinging sound, shuffling noises like footfalls, the sound of guitar strings, coins spinning on a wooden surface, coughing, and even a bloop, bloop, bloop sound. The investigators and the family all sat in the kitchen reviewing these findings, and Mike and Darren were absolutely shocked that they'd witnessed all this on the first day alone. For Mark and Marianne, though, this was their every waking moment. While Mike and Darren were mostly convinced about their findings, they also couldn't rule out the possibility of fraud. This initial skepticism is typical for many paranormal investigations, and they watched Mark and Marianne like hawks. They didn't suspect any dishonesty from them, though, and Darren later claimed that he could say with 100% certainty that they weren't responsible for the phenomena. The next day, on July 18th, around 2 p.m., Robert's large wooden train was tossed up from the ground and hit Mark on the head. Right after, he was hit by one of those yellow plastic nuts when it somehow fell from the ceiling, and a battery-operated toy car smashed straight into his back. And later that afternoon, Marianne and Robert were relaxing in the living room when he said something nobody wants to hear from their child. "There's a man here with us." Only Marianne couldn't see anyone. She looked around for a while before locking her eyes on a seat across the room. In the cushion, there was an impression so deep that a grown man could have been sitting on it, staring directly at her. She grabbed Robert and ran upstairs, but when they got to his room, he said the man had followed them. Now he was hovering over Robert's bed, almost like he was hungrily waiting for him to go to sleep. Marianne started panicking at this point, screaming and cursing because she was so confused. What the hell was happening in her home? As she was yelling, Robert saw a can of body spray fly through the air before hitting Marianne right in the back of her head. She reeled for a second and swung around, but there was nobody in the room except for them. It was just another reminder that this wasn't something they could defend themselves against. All they could do was hope for mercy. To get a better scope of the activity, Darren and Mike actually stayed overnight at the house several times throughout the investigation. On one of those nights, Darren found a silver kitchen knife lying on Robert's bedroom floor, and nobody had set it there.
Which now we're seeing the threat escalate further to the point of physical harm being done. I mean, physical objects are being thrown at people, causing injuries. I mean, this is quickly spiraling out of control. And I'm curious to know what the paranormal investigators are thinking at this point. I mean, the poor families being physically attacked, their sons being tormented, and, you know, they're still like, well, we got to do more investigation here. I mean, it seems like the logical solution here is get the hell out of this house.
Yeah.
I mean, if shit starts flying at my house and I'm getting pummeled by my kids' toys, I'm doing something about that. I'm leaving the house until 100%. I figure out a game plan on how to get rid of this. And on a different day, as Mike entered the house, he was welcomed by a carving knife. Come on. Darting across the kitchen, which bounced off a small TV on the counter before falling to the floor. Now you've got an object that can cause serious bodily harm or even potentially kill somebody. And one of the most remarkable aspects of the haunting was that the entity could hurl things through other solid objects. Darren reported seeing a coin fly from an empty part of the house, pass through a closed glass door, and then land in the next room.
That's insane.
Whoa. I mean, this is, we're entering a whole other territory here. The most common incidents, though, involve items being relocated throughout the home, which threw the family into utter chaos. They couldn't find their belongings, their wallets, keys, or important items when they needed them most, which what a pain in the ass that is. I get so pissed off when I can't find my keys or my wallet. I get legitimately angry. I want to punch something. Every single day began with them wondering what they would lose next. And things also became increasingly physical. For example, a rubber ball materialized on Robert's bed and was actually hot to the touch. A nightlight that was plugged into the wall socket at the top of the landing outside Robert's room pulled itself out of the wall, and they found it later on the floor underneath the socket. Among the most frequently relocated items in the home was an African lady statuette that usually sat on a shelf in the landing, but it was constantly moved and left on the stairs. And while investigators were trying to get to the heart of the haunting, Mark and Marianne also tried to help in any way possible. They just wanted their life to return to normal. One evening in late July, they went into Robert's room to try to contact Sammy. Mark said, "If this is you, Sammy, you have to stop it now. You frighten us. You might bring other things in the house, and if you do that, we won't be able to stay here." As the last word came out of Mark's mouth, they heard a mysterious thud from the corner of the room. It was Robert's electronic doodle board, similar to an Etch-a-Sketch, face down on the ground, and when Marianne went over and picked it up, chills ran down her spine, because it read, "I am sorry." At last, they were finally interacting with the spirit, or one of them, that was upending their lives. Marianne had an idea, and she erased the message and put it back inside a cupboard. She then told Sammy not to be naughty, then waited a few seconds. And when she took the board out, she couldn't believe her eyes. Now it read, "Okay, ma'am, but the..." And then it cut off. To the lower right of the board was a little creature, maybe a dog or a cat, that the spirit had drawn. It was incredible, and neither Mark nor Marianne had written on the doodle board, and the cupboard door had separated them. So they continued their conversation with this spirit, still reeling from this surreal experience. And initially, the exchange felt almost hopeful, but then the ghost abruptly dropped its facade. Marianne grabbed the board from the cupboard again, anxious to see what it had written next. This time, however, it spelled out just one single nauseating word.
Die.
This poltergeist was so powerful that it could easily manipulate physical objects and even communicate its feelings through writing. Mark and Marianne weren't the only ones who witnessed this either, because I think most of us would be very, very skeptical of this, right? I mean, come on, a spirit communicating through a doodle board?
It's a little silly.
It sounds a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
I don't know about you, Ian, but nothing makes my heart sink than finding out I've been spending countless dollars on a subscription that has just been running for months and months and months I forgot about.
And guess what makes it feel even better, though? Guess what makes that horrible, horrible feeling go away?
There is a way out, and that is all thanks to Rocket Money, because Ian and I have been able to get our subscriptions in check, in order, and get rid of all of those fatty, disgusting subscriptions that have been just leeching our bank accounts for countless months.
Countless months. I mean, I got a subscription just to watch the NBA Finals, and I'm not a sports guy. You know, I was rooting for the Knicks. That was it. Knicks won. Woohoo! Then I forgot. Now I'm spending $30 a month. Rocket Money reminded me. They were like, brother.
So that's what's great about Rocket Money, is it goes through, scans your accounts. Once you connect your bank account to Rocket Money, it's going to show you a nice, neat list of all the subscriptions you're paying for. And I'll guarantee you that you will find a subscription in there that you forgot you were paying for. And then you go look back at the history of your account and you're like, oh my God, I've been paying $10, $15, $20, $30 a month for this and I haven't used it in years. Rocket Money can do it with a couple taps of the button on the app for a lot of different subscriptions. They take that off your plate for you. Just give them a little bit of account information and boom, they go take care of the rest, deal with customer service for you. It's super simple, super easy to see all of your finances in this beautiful dashboard that they give you, with all these nice charts and graphs. The premium version is absolutely worth it, in my opinion, because then you get credit monitoring as well, which if you don't have any sort of credit monitoring going on right now, you need to.
Yes.
We're 100%. In the age of identity theft. It's happened to me. It can happen to you. Your accounts are constantly getting hacked and information leaked to the dark web and everywhere else, all the data brokers. And before you know it, that's why you're getting all these spam calls, spam texts, and everything. So have Rocket Money monitor your credit for you for just a couple bucks, it seems like. I mean, it's super, super cheap, and the app will save you money in the long run. It saved me hundreds of dollars, maybe even thousands of dollars at this point. I mean, it's just a no-brainer. We love Rocket Money. We know you will too. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings finally. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster.
Join at rocketmoney.com/lightsout. That's rocketmoney.com/lightsout. rocketmoney.com/lightsout.
But they aren't the only ones who saw this happen. Darren also reported the board telling him and Mike to just go now and stop it now. The investigators refused to leave the family, though, because they didn't think anyone else would be able to help them. It was a hostile situation, and it was only getting worse. Darren and Mike asked handwriting experts to review photos of the doodle board, and they compared it to different people who had been in the house recently, including Marianne's father and her brother Ian. The investigators were baffled by the experts' discovery that the handwriting samples most closely matched Mark's. Again, this was just a suggestion by these handwriting experts, but it made everyone feel a little bit uneasy. Because what the actual fuck, Mark? Could it be possible that Mark was responsible for some or all of the terrifying events unfolding in the home? He had been in the room with Marianne during the first instance, but from then on, the board was inside the cupboard every time words appeared. Things became more incriminating for Mark, though, when Marianne started receiving threatening texts from his phone. As they were sitting on the couch watching TV one night, Marianne's phone went off. And when she looked, it was a message from Mark that said, "Get you, bitch." Which bitch was spelled without a T. Obviously, she was staggered by this and turned on Mark. But he showed her his phone. It was completely dead. He even took the battery out to prove he wasn't the one sending the messages. And a moment later, another message from his phone appeared. "You're dead." She called Mike and Darren to come over and they inspected Mark's phone. They even took out his SIM card and put it on the table. But as soon as they did, another message popped up on Marianne's phone. "The bitch will die today." She then turned it off, petrified of what could come next. Then the landline rang and everyone went silent. She hesitantly answered it and a robotic voice read out, "Hi, hi, 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 hi," until she finally hung up the phone. And back in those days, you could actually send a text to a landline and it would read it out loud. This message was also from Mark's phone, which was now on the table with its battery and SIM card out of it.
Nothing could stop the messages from coming through. When Marianne turned her phone back on, there were even more texts, including one that read, "Going to die today. Going to get you." Everyone was in the room with all their phones on the table, watching the scene unfold. Darren tried to comfort her, explaining that the poltergeist was just feeding on her fear and that nothing bad would happen. Marianne just wanted to get away, though, and she later left for her mother's to try and clear her mind. On her way there, she called Mike because she was scared the ghost would follow her. And as they talked, more profane text messages came through. She read one to Mike, which said, "Please don't go. I will come with you, bitch." Again, bitch spelled without a T. Marianne was nearly hopeless at this point. She was completely drained, and Mark, too, was slowly becoming numb as he was battling his own grief in the midst of all this. Mike and Darren were also feeling defeated because every time it seemed the activity had reached its peak, they were proven wrong. They decided to bring in another investigator, Jill Butler, to the house on August 25th, 2006. She was a cheery, no-nonsense skeptic, and they hoped her practicality would comfort the family. Marianne greeted them, looking utterly exhausted, and Robert was outside, playing in the garden, distracted from the emotional turmoil. Marianne led Mike, Darren, and Jill up the stairs, and Mark followed behind everyone. When she got near the top, Mike saw her shoulders stoop in defeat. She said, "Oh my God, he started again." In the center of the room, on Robert's blue table, a stuffed bunny was positioned with a sharp carving knife in its hand, pressing it against the neck of a fluffy yellow duck. The duck itself looked like it had actually been killed, its feet in the air and wings slumped over by its side. They all took in the scene for a moment before Mark and Marianne brought Jill downstairs and Darren and Mike stayed behind to investigate. As they were finishing up and about to head downstairs, Darren felt something tap him on the back of the neck. It wasn't out of the ordinary, so they continued. As they were walking down the steps, a dog toy was hurled at Mike from behind, but it didn't hurt, and they moved on. They joined the other three in the kitchen and began discussing the events, but were interrupted by the sound of someone banging on the upstairs window. Darren then saw, through the kitchen window, two long blue Lego blocks crashing down from the upstairs and landing in the garden outside. It was becoming very clear that they would need to call it a night, otherwise they could easily spend hours watching the house being torn apart.
And in the early hours of the next morning, August 26th, at 3:30 a.m., Marianne was woken up by several toys slamming into her. Mark woke up and turned on the lamp, but was immediately drawn to the end of the bed. The corner of their duvet was being pressed down as if a hand was gently stroking it. Suddenly, the duvet was ripped away as if that hand had grabbed it, and Mark and Marianne wrestled to keep it on the bed. As they were pulling back as hard as they could, Mark said his whole body felt like it was burning. He ripped off his shirt, and Marianne could see red, swollen scratches. She could barely believe what she was seeing, but then more appeared, with red lines slowly cutting into his skin deeper and redder with each mark. And in total, she counted 13 scratches and cuts, which they have photo proof of. Mark was in shock and asked Marianne, "What's happening to me?" His already fragile emotional state was heading toward rock bottom. Marianne called Mike and he raced over to take pictures of the scratches, even though they were already fading. Then three of them went to check on Robert and found him in his bed in the middle of a disastrous room. He was sound asleep, but it looked like someone had ripped it apart. His table looked as though it had been warped and melted, twisting out of proportion. It was almost like a Salvador Dali painting. They had already experienced the flaming hot rubber ball in previous weeks, so did the spirit have the power to melt plastic? Jesus. As they're looking over the scene, the toy cupboard suddenly flung open and the light shade hanging from the ceiling started swinging back and forth, unprompted. Then Mike and Marianne saw something move across the landing. It was about 6.5 feet tall, a solid cluster of darkness, almost alien-like. Evil seemed to radiate off of it, sickening everyone and filling the room with a foreboding dread. Then it crept into Mark and Marianne's room, and when they followed it in there, Mark started overheating again. He lifted his shirt, and the older scratches were fading, but new ones quickly appeared. Welts started rising, and he looked almost sunburnt, his skin tight and hot. It looked as though he had been whipped with shallow bleeding cuts opening up along his side. Mike supposedly caught this all on camera, but the videos have never been released to protect the family's privacy. Mark headed to the bathroom to wash the cuts with cold water, and they noticed Robert's table had been returned to its normal condition. Was the poltergeist now making them hallucinate too? Reportedly, Mark was ultimately attacked on 5 separate occasions, and on 2 of those, additional witnesses saw the injuries as well. After that initial assault, the couple desperately wanted some sleep and asked Mike to stick around while they rested. They lay on the floor in the living room next to a blow-up mattress that Robert slept on because they couldn't stand to go upstairs anymore. It wasn't long after the family fell asleep that Mike noticed a haze forming in the air, almost as if someone was smoking a cigarette inside. And if you remember our episode on the Shea family haunting, they also experienced cigarette-like smoke in their home while battling a poltergeist infestation. And as Mike was staring at the haze dancing all around him, he suddenly felt something heavy pulling on the camera strap around his neck, and the pressure was so strong he couldn't resist it. Marianne woke up at that point and begged him to take it off because she was afraid it would strangle him. Thankfully, it stopped and the camera strap was released. Mike was also becoming emotionally drained at this point, so he got a water bottle and laid his head down on the table trying to process everything. Then the room quickly filled with a static charge and Mike raised his head. On the table in front of him, his water bottle tilted at a perfect 45-degree angle, suspended in an unnatural position, balancing on the thin rim at the bottom. He poked at it, and it wobbled but stayed put, and he continued looking at it, wondering how it could do this on its own. Mike took a picture and tried to replicate the angle later, but couldn't. After he left, Marianne received more threatening texts, with one reading, "Tonight is the night you die." She called Mike again and told him she was afraid she wouldn't be able to sleep, and then got another text. This time it said, "I can get you when you're awake, and I'll come for you when you're asleep, bitch." The text hadn't let up, so Mike called a friend, Stephen Swales. He was a senior lecturer in cybersecurity and also identified as a druid, which for those that don't know is a priest or miracle worker in the ancient Celtic religion. Stephen became interested in the electronic involvement of the haunting and advised that the family should turn off every electrical item in the house at night. Miraculously, the bloodthirsty poltergeist began to let up after that. Mike and Darren encouraged the family to try to keep themselves emotionally regulated as things wound down, since the entity thrived off negativity and, of course, fear. The activity may also have started to fade because they were so emotionally exhausted that the spirit had nothing left to work with. Which was interesting to me that as soon as the electrical devices go off, that the events seem to calm down a bit.
Right. It's like it was feeding off of it.
Feeding off the electromagnetic frequencies, yes, emitted by all these devices. Kind of interesting.
One other thing that I found interesting about this case is rarely do we see people directly ignore the spirits or poltergeist interactions with them. I mean, we had the entity throwing objects at these people and they were just ignoring it because it wasn't causing pain. And I don't think we've seen another case where they just straight up ignored these interactions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you would think you'd start raging on, right, whatever this thing is, but yeah, this is a very bizarre one because it's definitely outside the norm of what we've seen in other Poltergeist cases or Enfield or any of the, you know, more popular ones. It just seems like they're kind of accepting that this is happening, and we just got to make do the best we can. And it's interesting that they don't seek any other help besides Mike and Darren.
No, it's just at this point, I would have called the priest.
Yeah. Right. Why not? I mean,
something.
You know, call somebody to do something. I mean, they're just kind of like, well, we're observing all these things, but, you know, and we're terrified, but we'll just make do. And never once do they decide like to leave.
No.
Like if the family leaves the home, does the activity continue?
Right. We've seen the entity make threats over text that it can be, that they can follow the family, but we've never seen any proof of it directly. So it'd be worth a shot in my eyes.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. They make it super simple. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with coverage options tailored to your choices. Plus, you'll see which discounts you may qualify for, like the online quote discount or savings for paying in full. In fact, 99% of Progressive Auto customers earn at least one discount. See if you could save when you switch to Progressive. You'll feel good about making a savvy choice. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little extra cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
I don't know about you, Ian, but nothing makes my heart sink than finding out I've been spending countless dollars on a subscription that has just been running for months and months and months I forgot about.
And guess what makes it feel even better, though? Guess what makes that horrible, horrible feeling go away?
There is a way out, and that is all thanks to Rocket Money, because Ian and I have been able to get our subscriptions in check, in order, and get rid of all of those fatty, disgusting subscriptions that have been just leeching our bank accounts for countless months.
I mean, I got a subscription just to watch the NBA finals, and I'm not a sports guy. You know, I was rooting for the Knicks. That was it. Knicks won, woohoo. Then I forgot. Now I'm spending $30 a month. Rocket Money reminded me. They were like, brother.
So that's what's great about Rocket Money, is it goes through, scans your accounts. Once you connect your bank account to Rocket Money, it's going to show you a nice, neat list of all the subscriptions you're paying for. And I'll guarantee you that you will find a subscription in there that you forgot you were paying for. And then you go look back at the history of your account and you're like, oh my God, I've been paying $10, $15, $20, $30 a month for this and I haven't used it in years. Rocket Money can do it with a couple taps of the button on the app for a lot of different subscriptions. They take that off your plate for you. Just give them a little bit of account information and boom, they go take care of the rest, deal with customer service for you. It's super simple, super easy to see all of your finances in this beautiful dashboard that they give you with all these nice charts and graphs. The premium version is absolutely worth it, in my opinion, because then you get credit monitoring as well, which if you don't have any sort of credit monitoring going on right now, you need to.
Yes.
We're in the 100% age of identity theft. It's happened to me. It can happen to you. Your accounts are constantly getting hacked and information leaked to the dark web and everywhere else, all the data brokers. And before you know it, that's why you're getting all these spam calls, spam texts, and everything. So have Rocket Money monitor your credit for you for just a couple bucks, it seems like. I mean, it's super, super cheap, and the app will save you money in the long run. It saved me hundreds of dollars, maybe even thousands of dollars at this point. I mean, it's just a no-brainer. We love Rocket Money. We know you will too. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings finally. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals faster.
Join at rocketmoney.com/lightsout. That's rocketmoney.com/lightsout. rocketmoney.com/lightsout.
A few weeks later, though, on September 30th, 2006, Mark asked Mike to watch a scary video he had taken on his phone. Mike had been running errands with his wife, Jackie, and his father, but decided to pop by. Both Jackie and his father had a clear view of Mike and Mark through a window in the house as they waited out in the car. And when Mike returned, they asked him about the third man in the room. He said no one else was in there, but they insisted they had seen someone. They described the strange man as having blonde hair and wearing a beige t-shirt and blue denim jeans. And according to Jackie and his father, he was trying to get Mike and Mark's attention the whole time they were in there. It was mind-boggling because the regular-looking guy they saw was the complete opposite of what you would expect a ghost of this caliber to look like. After that last encounter, there was supposedly one last week of volatile activity before the spirit departed the home for good, and nothing has been reported since.
Very curious.
I mean, yeah, that's a fair point. The beige t-shirt, the blue denim jeans, the blonde haircut, that's not what we imagine a poltergeist or spirit at all, especially one that has seemed so intentional with its actions and, frankly, threats.
Yeah, it's just what's really confusing to me about this is that poltergeists, according to most experts and most people in the paranormal field, are not human spirits.
Right.
It's a noisy ghost, but it's really just, you know, a ball of energy, so to speak. It's not necessarily tied to any human spirit in any way, or really any sort of paranormal entity, demon, whatever you want to call it. And so it's interesting to me that we, you know, throughout this whole thing, we're calling it a poltergeist, but it's a specific human spirit, it seems. But I mean, you know, the definition of a poltergeist really just depends on the person and the investigator. But I mean, in Enfield and in other cases, I guess they're, you know, they were attributed to something appearing as a human. And I don't know, it's just one of those things we don't fully understand. But
Right. Interesting
that it's just a regular looking bloke. The 42 Lock Street investigation sparked controversy after Darren and Mike published their book in 2008. Okay, now we got a book coming out. The South Shields Poltergeist, One Family's Fight Against an Invisible Intruder, which critics thought lacked credibility and evidence to back it up. Darren and Mike also didn't publish their photos and videos online. Although they wanted to protect the family, they faced heavy backlash because they claimed the case was one of the most well-documented hauntings in British history, which if you're going to make a claim like that, then bring the evidence to back it up.
Exactly. You can edit the photos.
Yeah, exactly. You can blur faces and you can make the family anonymous.
Exactly.
While still releasing evidence, which is interesting. These investigators claim that they have collected over 500 digital photos, 24 hours of video footage, and 4.5 hours of audio footage. And how much of that can we show you?
Zero.
A few photos. I want to hear the audio. Like, where's this 24 hours of video footage? I mean, and that's the really frustrating thing with most paranormal investigations cases is that they gatekeep.
Mm-hmm.
They gatekeep all of this supposed evidence when, why would you do that? If you really captured something as incredible and terrifying as this poltergeist, why on earth would you not want everybody to see that?
Right.
I mean, it's just going to add credibility to you as an investigator. And will probably propel your career far, far more than just keeping it all to yourself and writing a book. I mean,
it would increase your book sales.
Absolutely. It would increase everything about your career. People were also skeptical about the water bottle story and even sought to disprove its rarity by replicating the positioning, which I was going to say this earlier. I've done this before.
Oh yeah.
It's like the oldest little trick in the book. It's not that hard to do.
Every bored high schooler has done this.
Yes, I was going to say, This was like huge in high school. Like, can I make this can tilt on its 45 degree angle? I mean, if you haven't tried this, do it. Do it right now. It's really not that hard. On the flip side, the haunting was so well studied that Alan Murdy published his own review of the case for an academic journal. Alan was a longtime paranormal investigator and the chairman of the Ghost Club, which is reportedly the world's oldest paranormal society. He asked Darren and Mike to meet with him on October 11, 2009, a few years after the haunting, to review 450 pictures taken during the investigation. And he was fully convinced it was genuine evidence. And after thoroughly reviewing the case files in 2009 and 2010, he published a favorable review of Mike and Darren's book and the case materials for the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research. There, he also claimed that it was one of the most well-documented spontaneous paranormal events in recent history. Again, lots of bold claims.
Yes,
why can't the public see all of this profound evidence you've reviewed?
I completely agree with you.
We want to see it.
Yeah. Blur the faces. And with all that information, there has to be evidence that doesn't have direct correlation and direct descriptors of the family. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be.
No. Just call it a house. Yeah.
show us the audio at least. There were over 17 different independent witness testimonies, and 22 if you include the family in question. They all provided signed statements attesting to what they experienced in the home and how devastating it all was. Some scholars have proposed that the family's infestation resulted from haunted people syndrome. It's a framework that describes recurring supernatural experiences as being connected to extreme psychological stress, sensory factors, social context, and paranormal beliefs. Some also believe this syndrome can actually trigger macro psychokinetic events. If you remember from other haunting episodes, psychokinesis is a phenomenon where someone can control inanimate objects with their mind. And the scholars here were proposing that Mark was the source of the psychokinesis because of his recent trauma and internal anxiety, which could have manifested outward as an invisible, destructive force. Critics have also wondered if the investigators actually made the presence angrier. It was suggested that documenting it could have fed the poltergeist and tempted it even more. This also ties into what some paranormal writers call poltergeist contagion, where, even though the entity is focused on one person, witnesses or investigators can make it attached to them as well. Another remarkable feature of this case was that it's been described as one of the most violent outbreaks in British poltergeist history. In most cases, things throughout the house are broken and destroyed, but in this one, the poltergeist manifested specifically in technology, threatening Marianne's life. This is a rare phenomenon, and the investigators on this case said it was one of the things that set it apart. And usually with poltergeists, an extreme threat to life is one of the last things to happen. Usually, this is the big climax in a haunting. But in the case of 42 Lock Street, the poltergeist doubled down and continued threatening Marianne until the very end. It was also extraordinary because they usually go after younger people, specifically teenagers. Some have suggested that since Mark was undergoing severe anxiety and stress at the time, he became the primary target of the violence. It also physically assaulted him, which was another rare instance in this unique case. Lastly, it is unexplainable and incredibly rare that this poltergeist attacked all three family members in one way or another.
And of course, as a result of all this, the South Shields case received extensive national media coverage, and the supposed in-depth documentation from Mike and Darren piqued the interest of both the public and paranormal circles. Darren has said that what he and Mike experienced in South Shields changed our way of thinking and forced us to realize that reality is certainly not what we thought it was. He also has said in his own experience that 15 years on, I still sit and contemplate with an open jaw, completely bewildered at what we experienced in that house in South Tyneside. The poltergeist at 42 Lock Street was so violent and prolific that it's been compared to the Enfield poltergeist. Both entities were fascinated by Legos and spoke in unnatural, gruff voices. Guy Lyon Playfair, the renowned paranormal investigator who worked on the Enfield case, even wrote the foreword for Mike and Darren's book. Guy's willingness to write the foreword for the case was a significant endorsement, showing the true credibility of this destructive haunting. And for Mark and Marianne, the experience nearly destroyed their lives. Poltergeist infestations can be extremely damaging to a relationship, since most people can't just get up and move away. It also made things worse when some experts were questioning whether Mark might have been the one behind the written harassment. As far as we know, there have been no further reports on the family since the case, and no further activity has been reported in the home as they wish to remain anonymous. One can only imagine they're still dealing with the immense trauma of 42 Lock Street and the entity that possessed it. In these cases, it's like your house doesn't belong to you. Your belongings are subject to spirits' whims, and even your physical safety is compromised. And the only way they could defeat this poltergeist, maybe even a demon, was to drain its life force, which seemed to be electricity. For Mark and Marianne, there was only one escape, and that was through darkness. Who would have thought to free yourself from something hiding in the shadows, you'd have to go lights out? I mean, they just live in complete darkness now,
yeah.
I guess.
Candlelight.
Candlelight, yeah. Just go back to the old days here. I mean, it's a lot to wrap your head around. I am definitely a paranormal believer. I think this type of stuff does happen. I think there's a lot of unexplained activity that happens. And I think perhaps even in this case, there was some paranormal activity that really happened. But there is a part of me that wonders, if it all was legitimate, because mm-hmm. it's almost a little too convenient the way that this plays out, especially since we now, you know, that they were going for this book, you know, with the massive success that the Enfield Poltergeist case had. Mm-hmm. And, you know, afterwards with the books and with the subsequent films, it's always kind of in the back of my mind of, it was there other intentions behind this? You know, whether or not this was really going on, was there a, you know, sort of master plan?
Right.
Because it's interesting to me that, you know, these two paranormal investigators are really the sole owners over all of the evidence in this particular house. And I think I'm always left with, why did they not let anyone else come in?
Right.
And in other cases, what I think adds a lot of credibility is when you report this to law enforcement, especially in those early days when you don't know fully whether or not this is something paranormal, or is this some creep that's fucking with your family or breaking into your house.
Right.
And they get involved, they come and they observe and document and report their findings. So it's that's the part that really raises a bit of skepticism with me, at least with this case, is the fact that this experience was really isolated to Mike and Darren and the family. And outside of that, we don't really have anybody else who can attest to a lot of the activity here.
I mean, I completely agree. I think there was plenty of opportunities where they had complete justification to contact law enforcement. I mean, those threatening messages, although they were supposedly coming from Mark, I think that it's an appropriate time to reach out to law enforcement and just tell them that I'm receiving these messages, but they're not coming from Mark.
Yeah.
There could be something else going on. It's just, and on top of that, like you said, like you spoke of before, the evidence. There's supposedly just these mountains of evidence that they're not releasing to the public. And that seems very damning to me. It seems like they're trying to hide something.
It's hard not to think that. And I mean, it's like, for me, there's a couple other points where it almost feels a little too convenient, where they reach out to their friend that's the cybersecurity expert who's like, oh yeah, yeah, that can't possibly happen. So clearly that's what's going on. But it's like, did he actually physically get this device? Did he actually look through it? I mean, it's all, you know, it's all contained within this tight circle of people. And that's really where the story lives. And without seeing the extensive evidence, I think most of us kind of walk away from this and be like, yeah, I mean, is it possible all this happened the way they said it did? Absolutely. Yeah. But I think there's at least like a 10% part of us, maybe probably more for most of us, that are like, I don't know, seems a little bit convenient. And then, you know, Mark's sort of role in all this, yes, he was physically attacked, but, and yes, there were scratches, but we don't know that these scratches were done by something paranormal. It could have been him. He could have been scratching himself. And they just said that. I mean, there's so many holes that you could poke in this.
I mean, I could attest from personal experience when I go through periods of extreme stress, like I get hot. And then if I do scratch myself, I get red raised bumps. There's a histamine reaction that your body has to stress. And this is a stressful situation. So I could see that just being a natural reaction that he has. I don't think that was anything paranormal, in my personal opinion.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, when you're under duress and dealing with, what's the dynamic between Marianne and Mark? What's their marriage like? You know, what kind of relationship issues could be going on there? I mean, there's a lot of other things to the story. And the fact that we don't have any background information on this family, we don't have any sort of health history going on here that's available to us. I think one of the possibilities, even with Robert, is he could have been sleepwalking. I mean, kids sleepwalk. My daughter sleepwalks.
Yeah.
And it's very, very common. And is it possible that Robert, you know, was asleep when he got up out of bed and moved his whole, you know, bed around and made a mess of the bedroom and then walked to some closet within the house and got locked inside of it? It's possible. I think there's a lot of logical explanations to this one that I would want to see further investigated. And I think that it was very lightly investigated.
I agree.
Almost maybe not investigated at all without seeing the evidence. You know, we have this very, very crazy story. I mean, it's as far as the story goes, it's really good.
It is.
It's really enticing. But just calling it the most documented poltergeist case in British history, I mean, I think you got to come with a little bit more evidence than a few pictures. Yeah. I mean, I want to hear the audio. I want to hear this thing talk. Because I think, as you said, withholding that just raises that that skepticism.
Exactly. If you have all this evidence, like you said, the most documented case in British history, but you can't see any of it. It's...
Come on.
Mm.
And the solution to all this was just unplug things?
Come on.
That should have been the first thing they tried. If they thought they were dealing with a poltergeist, that to me, that'd be the first thing you do. Unplug everything in the house, see if the activity continues. And I mean, there's, I could go through an infinite list of other things that I would have looked for that I would have tried before. I would have just been like, oh, we're under attack. not much we can do about it. I don't know. I think there's always sort of this 50-50 with cases like this particular one where it's like 50%. Yeah, this was the fucking craziest poltergeist case or demonic possession case. Yeah. It seems like a lot of the activity is something more than just a poltergeist to me. It seems like this is something darker and more sinister, perhaps, but or this is one of the, you know, best executed paranormal hoaxes. But again, maybe there's stuff out there we just didn't come across or find, and maybe there is a treasure trove of evidence that's available somewhere. We certainly couldn't find it, and we dug pretty hard to look. But I want to know what you think. Let us know your thoughts on this one. Do you think this is a legitimate poltergeist case? Do you think this was a poltergeist at all? Do you think there's a possibility that this was somebody within the home, perhaps orchestrated effort between the family, Mike and Darren, with maybe hopes of turning this into the next Enfield case? Yes. Because of the notoriety that one did. I mean, I think that's a very real possibility, because it's interesting, this one, once the story is captured, it comes to this grand conclusion.
Well, there was no grand conclusion.
Right, right. Well, it just
fizzled out. It just stopped.
Just stopped. They unplugged some shit.
Yeah.
And so, and I meant grand conclusion as when it comes to their book.
Right, right.
You know, the book story. That they're just like, okay, everything's fine now. No reported activity has happened since. And it's just like, really? It just kind of ended that easy? When this is the craziest fucking violent paranormal case ever reported in Britain? I don't know. A little suspect. A little sus on that. But yeah, let us know your thoughts. And thank you for being here for another episode of Lights Out. Ian will be back next week. And we'll be diving into a very, very dark and disturbing case together. But till then, lights out, everybody.